Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, June 27, 2020. Coronavirus in Midland. Restaurant owners address latest setback by Stuart Doreen. S. Doreen at HurstonP.com. When restaurant owners heard about Governor Greg Abbott's executive orders closing down bars again and reducing restaurant capacity to 50%, at least a few thought about their brethren in the bar business. "My friends in bar industry, they barely came out after being reopened," said Jerry Morales, owner of three restaurants, including Mulberry Cafe and Gerardo's Casita. "I don't know if they will survive it. I am nervous for them." But they said there also will be an impact to restaurants as well. The governor has called for restaurant capacity to move from 75% capacity to 50% on Monday, and, according to Morales, the return of 6 feet spacing. "This is a setback," Morales said. "There are a lot of restaurants that don't have the spacing, and they will see their revenue dollars roll back, and that will be challenging." Morales said he fears this setback also will have an impact on the perception of the industry. The former state and regional restaurant association leader said restaurateurs have spent money on sanitizing, purchasing protective equipment, glass partitions, and training of employees to serve during a pandemic. He said that the investment has taken place while bringing in less revenue because of capacity restrictions. He said local restaurant owners also have been impacted by the downturn in the oil industry and higher unemployment rate, as there are fewer people with the extra dollars to eat out. At the same time, COVID has played a factor in the increase in the cost of ground beef, about 100%, he said, and produce. He said if the payroll protection program hadn't been in place previously, there would have been more restaurants shut down. He worried that there is less of that PPP money left and costs will catch up. "A large percentage will not make it and close down," Morales said. "A lot of prayers are needed in this community." Jose Cuevas, owner of the Jumburrito franchise, said his quick service restaurants haven't been impacted as much. He said that before the pandemic, Jumburrito's business was 70% drive-through already, and only half of those coming into the restaurant were staying to eat. "Jumburrito never opened the dining room even after the governor allowed restaurants to open," Cuevas said. "Safety was the utmost importance, and I was willing to give up sales," he said. Cuevas talked about how it is different for sit-down restaurants and how they had to get entrepreneurish by selling eggs, ground beef, and alcohol when restrictions were put into place the first time. "They had to make a decision to stay alive," Cuevas said. Again, both men talked about what the governor's latest restrictions will mean to the restaurant industry in the short and long term. "There will be issues such as transitioning to delivery and catering in the short term. There also is the uncertainty that these restrictions create a reluctance for people to return to a sit-down setting, even if the perception created doesn't match what they think is the reality." Restaurant owner hopes for fewer government restrictions. By J.C. Lewis. jc.lewis@hurstmp.com. Rusty Bucket Barbecue and Tavern co-owner Matt Finlay is worried about what Governor Greg Abbott's order of reduced capacity will mean for his restaurant on West Industrial Avenue. He said Friday afternoon that a concert with Texas country musician K.C. Donahue would be presented as planned Friday night. His venue can usually hold around 2,019 people, but he expected to lose money. Restaurants may remain open for dine-in service, but beginning Monday at a capacity not to exceed 50% of total listed indoor occupancy. Restaurants are currently operating at 75% of the total listed occupancy. "I don't want to put a dollar amount in an interview, but it's going to cost us a whole lot of money," Finlay said. "We've already bought everything to supply food-wise and drink-wise because he," Governor Greg Abbott, said the other day he wasn't going to shut us down until after the 4th of July, after he looked at the numbers. "So we have a ton of stuff that now half of it will probably go bad." Finlay said he doesn't agree with the decision and believes that coronavirus numbers are being skewed. The Midland Health Department reported the number of confirmed cases Friday reached 563. The Department of State Health Services reported 137,624 on its website today. Finlay said Friday he personally knows people who have tested positive and had to get retested in order to be clear to go back to work. "I think the numbers are skewed," he said. "People are being retested, and those numbers are going to make everything go up. The numbers aren't accurate. If you're scared or elderly or sick, then absolutely stay home. But I don't think you can keep everybody in. This first shutdown, I know 5 restaurants that are never going to open again. So how many are going to close before this next one is over?" There are other restaurant owners who share the belief that another setback will negatively impact restaurants across Midland to the point where they might have to close. They also worried about bars, which were shut down again, as Abbott's executive order Friday basically shut down establishments that receive more than 51% of their gross receipts from the sale of alcoholic beverages. The businesses may remain open for delivery and takeout, including for alcoholic beverages, as authorized by the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission. The Rusty Bucket Barbecue and Tavern has been open for 8 months, and this will be the second time government has tightened its restrictions on Finley's business. "We're going to survive, but it's going to be rough, and some places aren't going to survive it," he said. "All you are doing is killing your state by doing this. It should be left up to the people." Finlay said he won't be able to run his full staff with only half the business coming in. "They can't afford to be out of work either," he said. "We've separated our tables even farther, and we have taken away seats. But in the end, I don't know if I can keep everyone in my staff busy. We're not shutting down the rioters and everything else that is happening in the community, but they want to shut down business owners that are trying to help the community thrive," Finlay said. "I just don't agree with it. I love our governor and I love our state, but something has to give before we bankrupt everybody." Midland bars closed after order. Want top priority to be safety. By J.C. Lewis. jc.lewis@hurstmp.com. Want beer? Visit Tall City Brewing Company website, tallcitybrewing.com, for information on growlers and restaurants where the beer is sold. Governor Greg Abbott announced Friday morning that he is closing Texas bars in response to the post-reopening coronavirus surge, according to a Texas Tribune story. Bars were told to close at noon on Friday. Tall City Brewing Company co-founder and manager Jeff Thomas said he wasn't surprised and was expecting another shutdown. However, he wished they had been told sooner. "I wish there was a bit more notice given to us, because this morning they told us to close by noon, so that was a bit disappointing. And that's hard to turn on a dime like that, but we're going to do our best," Thomas said. "Our main priority is the safety of our community. Unfortunately, we had to shut down, but we hope this is the last time we have to. So let's curb the numbers, be safe, be responsible, and do a turnaround so we can get back to normal, whatever that may be." Thomas said he has been in contact with staff and had a meeting with all the owners Friday morning to figure out what will happen going forward. During the first shutdown, the brewery had been doing curbside growlers, which they will resume. "Everyone is disappointed and bummed, but we are going to do the best we can to continue to do curbside growlers," Thomas said. "The good thing is that we have experience and we know what to expect now and how to manage it to be as efficient as possible." He said curbside growlers is a great way to support the brewery, but he also said the biggest support would be to support restaurants that are open and serving their beer. He said they distribute to 40 different restaurants and bars. Restaurants serving Tall City Brewing Company beer include Librado, Cork and Pig Odessa, Red Oak Kitchen, Opal's Table, Longhorn Steakhouse, The Patio Draft House, Pie Social, and Torino's Pizza Bar. "To support the restaurants and to support us where they serve our beer, buy our beer there," he said. "That's a win-win for the restaurants and for us." Tall City Brewing Company has 12 beers now on tap, and they have added a couple of beers to the menu with another beer on the way. The brewery added Haze Y'all, which is an IPA with tropical and citrus notes of tangerine and mango, and Carol Smashkin, which is a blonde beer that's single malt and single hop at 4.2% ABV. "We want people to get out and promote and do what they can to be safe, while also supporting local business," he said. "I know that's not as easy as it sounds, but there is a way to do it." General manager and small interest owner of the bar, Judy Ferris, said personally she believes the bar industry is at the mercy of the people, not so much at the mercy of the government during the pandemic. She said the bar industry needs people to get on board with guidelines and care about other people's safety. She said a lot of bars were overcrowding and not following guidelines. She posted a statement on the bar's Facebook page explaining to customers what needs to happen in order for bars to reopen sooner. The post states, "Regardless of your personal position concerning the virus, this was really very easy to avoid. If all bars would have simply followed the suggested health requirements to slow the spread of the virus, this wouldn't have happened. As is the case in any situation, the few who blatantly refuse to simply control capacities and use strict sanitation procedures ruined it for the majority who were." She said that many bars have been following guidelines, but it was the few bars and some customers who didn't want to follow the rules. "The bar industry hasn't been targeted for any other reason than the obvious," she said. "It's where people congregate in large groups, move around, and interact closely with other individuals and groups over extended periods of time." She said it makes sense that the age group of people in their 20s and 30s have had increased numbers of coronavirus cases because they are the ones who most go to bars. "We need people to change, not so much the government," she said. "We need people to care about each other. Don't go to the bars that are overcrowding and not doing what they're supposed to do, because this is the end result of it." Ferris said that the bar has been a staple in Midland for 40 years and will reopen when it is deemed safe again. Woody's Hideaway was closed at 11:45 a.m., and the manager didn't want to speak about the order. The Blue Door removed the patio seating, and owner Erica Mann also didn't want to comment on the executive order. She said she will be focusing on taking care of her business and staff who were communicated with first thing Friday morning about the order. Streak of Daily Coronavirus Records Ends by Stuart Doreen. As Doreen at HurstMP.com. The week ended with a lower daily number of confirmed coronavirus cases inside Midland County. The Midland Health Department reported that for the first time this week, the number of cases was less than 30. The 28 cases reported Friday stopped the streak of four straight days with a single day record total, but means that the week ended with 281 total cases and with 563 cases during the entire pandemic. Over the past 2 days, younger people have accounted for most of the 69 cases. The health department reports 56 of the 69 were Midland County residents younger than 50, and again the 20-somethings led the way with 22. During the course of the pandemic, there have been 174 confirmed cases in the 20 to 29 age range. The only other age group with 100 or more confirmed cases is the 30 to 39 age group with 100. For the second straight day, the number of people who have recovered from their COVID-19 case stayed at 119. The number of people in the hospital rose from 14 on Wednesday to 18 on Friday. Total cases: Monday, 95. Tuesday, 37. Wednesday, 40. Thursday, 41. Friday, 28. This week, 281. Total through Wednesday, 563. Gender: male, 266, female, 297. Age range: 0 to 19, Wednesday, 53, Friday, 67. 20 to 29, Wednesday, 152, Friday, 174. 30 to 39, Wednesday, 88, Friday, 100. 40 to 49, Wednesday, 58, Friday, 66. 50 to 59, Wednesday, 54, Friday, 62. 60 to 69, Wednesday, 37, Friday, 41. 70 to 79, Wednesday, 26, Friday, 26. 80 plus, Wednesday, 26, Friday, 27. Patient status: home isolation, Wednesday, 338, Friday, 402. Recovered, Wednesday, 119, Friday, 119. Death, Wednesday, 14, Friday, 14. Hospital, Wednesday, 14, Friday, 18. Nursing rehab, Wednesday, 9, Friday, 10. Source of exposure: contact to a known case, Wednesday, 246, Friday, 270. Community transmission, Wednesday, 149, Friday, 186. Travel related, Wednesday, 88, Friday, 98. Under investigation, Wednesday, 11, Friday, 9. Source: Midland Health Department. 10 Ector Jail inmates test positive for virus. County's total number of confirmed cases increases by 26, for a total of 506. by J.C. Lewis. jc.lewis@hurstmp.com. The Ector County Law Enforcement Center reported that 10 inmates have tested positive, and tests are currently pending on 10 additional inmates, according to a press release. In addition, one officer has tested positive and has been quarantined. Tests are pending on 6 other officers who also are being quarantined. Transportation of inmates outside the facility, except for medical reasons, has been suspended. Recreation for inmates has been temporarily suspended with the approval of the Texas Commission on Jail Standards, according to the release. No inmates or jail employees are or have been hospitalized for coronavirus. The Ector County Sheriff's Office has reduced the movement in the jail so as to try to prevent the spread of coronavirus. The jail is sanitized throughout the day. All individuals who are arrested and brought to the jail are screened by a nurse, according to the release. Dr. Tim Benton, who works at Medical Center Hospital, said Friday 4 nursing homes in Odessa have had positive cases, which were reported by the Ector County Health Department. 2 facilities have had cases in the past 2 days, he said. 14 tests are pending at the Park Senior Living for test results after 1 positive. 4 people are positive at Sienna Nursing and Rehabilitation. There are 6 symptomatic residents with pending results. There is 1 positive case at Deering's Nursing and Rehabilitation, and there are 18 positive cases at Focused Care in Odessa. ECHD has hired 6 of the 15 positions available for contact tracers. Medical Center Health System CEO and President Russell Tippin said MCH is treating 23 patients. Of these, 18 are on the isolation floor. 2 of the patients are from Alpine, 1 is from Ward Memorial Hospital, 1 from Reeves County Hospital, 1 is from Focused Care in Odessa, and 1 is from Focused Care at Crane. The CCU floor has 5 patients with 3 on ventilators. Of the CCU patients, 1 is from Ward Memorial Hospital, 1 is from the Big Bend area, and 1 is from Focused Care in Odessa. Odessa Regional Medical Center CEO and President Stacy Brown said they have 9 patients in the ICU during this time. Total hospitalizations are at 32 patients, with 14 patients in ICU and 5 patients on ventilators. ECHD reported that the number of confirmed cases jumped by 26 new on Friday, bringing the total to 506. The number of probable cases stands at 301, after 47 were reported on Friday. The health department has contact traced 2,982 people. Total tests taken are at 7,346, with 5,494 negative results and 1,346 pending results. ECHD reported that 209 patients have recovered from coronavirus.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Saturday, June 27th, 2020. Governor Closes Bars by Michael Merlot. While Governor Greg Abbott ordered bars to close and restaurants scaled back to 50% occupancy on Friday, Odessa Mayor David Turner said that there will be an emergency meeting about a mask order on Monday. The meeting will take place at 10 a.m. at Floyd Gwynn Park in the Powell Gym, 1015 West County Road. I can issue the order, Turner said, but we have to make sure that council understands everything because they have to approve it in 7 days. Turner said during Friday's hospital briefing that he's received threats from people trying to keep him from proceeding with a mask mandate, but that he didn't think any of them were serious. Turner said he doesn't want to shut down, and that's why he is looking to the mandate. He also said that he didn't think that law enforcement would be stricter on bars refusing to close, but that the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission will come in and pull liquor licenses. As the county scaled back, detailing that they would only release updated case numbers on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, Dr. Timothy Benton was the only health department authority available to speak on the issue, saying that the health department would need time to catch up and need more employees to be able to inform the public on a daily basis again. It's just a matter of getting through the volume of work. Obviously, they'll count the numbers and keep the data going, adding that some health department staff are putting in long hours, sometimes more than 6 days a week. The health department has hired 6 of the 15 positions that they've offered, Benton said. Of course, that'll take them a little bit of time to get them trained and fully up to speed, he said. He also updated that the health department will use their Facebook page more to disperse information. He also said that the health department is still looking for contact tracers. Benton's cleared up some of the confusion around probable tests, saying that the probable tests are not all antigen tests. He said that the health department is following the guidelines that if you have an antigen test, then you also have to meet criteria of either being exposed to a known positive or being symptomatic. So those are the only people being listed as probables. Not all rapid tests go under the category of probable. Some rapid tests are PCR, and any PCR test that is positive is a confirmed case. The probables are becoming overwhelming, he said, adding that some of them are being investigated. Benton said that the National Guard returned July 1st and 2nd for testing, and people interested can call 512-883-2400. Clinical pathology labs are reportedly scaling back on which swabs they will be taking because of the recent surge creating a backlog of tests. To get caught up, they will only be processing hospitalized patients' tests, an MCH representative detailed. MCH Chief Nursing Officer Kristen Timmons said that CPL communicated that after 10 days of catching up with tests, they would look at what their capabilities are. I think that thousands of tests that they've received at one time has kind of put them on a backload, she said. The health department showed on their website Friday that there have been 807 total cases of COVID-19 in the county, with 506 confirmed and 301 probable. 290 have recovered from the virus, and 510 people are being reported as active. The website also showed that 32 people are currently hospitalized, 14 in ICU, and 5 on ventilators. A press release from Medical Center Hospital detailed that 265 patients have tested positive and 23 are in the hospital. 18 patients are on 7 Central, including 2 from Big Bend Regional, 1 from Ward Memorial, 1 from Reeves County Hospital, 1 from Focused Care at Odessa, and 1 from Focused Care at Crane. 5 patients are in the critical care unit, including 1 from Ward Memorial, 1 from Big Bend Regional, and 1 from Focused Care at Odessa. 3 of those patients are reportedly on a ventilator. No persons under investigation are in the hospital, and 464 tests are pending. MCH reported that they have 30 beds on 7 Central, 20 beds in the CCU, and currently 23 of the 50 COVID-19 beds are taken. They have a surge plan should they need more beds, the release detailed. Odessa Regional Medical Center President Stacy Brown reported that out of 813 total tests, 59 people have tested positive, 571 have tested negative, and 180 tests are pending. 9 patients are in the ICU and 2 are on ventilators. 7 are from Odessa, 2 from Crane, she said. She also reported 1 new COVID-19 related death at the hospital. The county website did not include that death on their website. 2 people were discharged and there were 4 new admissions Thursday, Brown said. The Ector County Sheriff's Office detailed in a press release that 10 inmates at the Ector County Law Enforcement Center have tested positive for COVID-19 and 10 inmate tests are pending. 1 officer tested positive and is in quarantine, and 6 other officers have pending tests and are quarantined at home. The release detailed that transportation of inmates outside the facility has been suspended except for medical reasons, and inmate recreation has also been suspended with the approval of the Texas Commission on Jail Standards and collaborative efforts and cooperation with local and state agencies. No employees or inmates are reportedly hospitalized from COVID-19, the report detailed, and ECSO is sanitizing all parts of the jail throughout the day. All people who are arrested and brought to the jail are reportedly screened by a nurse. In other COVID-19 news, Chris Tovar, the divisional director for MCH Urgent Cares, said that the average test for an uninsured patient trying to get a COVID-19 test at one of the urgent cares is $350. In an additional note, the owner of Big Daddy Zane's, Gabrielle Ellison, was operating her bar in violation of Texas Governor Greg Abbott's new order that shut bars back down and limited restaurant capacity to 50% following a surge in coronavirus cases. Center opened for in-person services by Ruth Campbell. Family Resiliency Center coordinator Chandra Quintanar is no stranger to trauma and wants to help people in the Permian Basin come to terms with the onslaught that has hit the area in recent months. Along with the shootings, there is the COVID-19 pandemic, protests, and unrest touched off by the death of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis. Quintanar grew up overseas. Her parents were missionaries in Africa, and her experience instilled a desire in her to help people. "I had a very unique introduction to trauma," she said. "When I was 15, there was civil unrest in the country where we lived, and we were actually evacuated, and so were given 24 hours to get everything we wanted to keep and get out. At that point, we'd been there for 7 years, so that was home." She had two siblings, one of whom was about 2.5 at the time. "We had to gather everything we could gather and leave our home behind. There was mass violence involved, not directed at us, but obviously around us. That was kind of my first, this is what this kind of thing looks like experience. When I was 17, my mom was killed by a drunk driver, and so I got to deal with that trauma as well," Quintanar said. She earned her undergraduate degree in psychology from Liberty University and a graduate degree in professional counseling from the same school. "In 2011, I began working with a crisis center. I was living in Houston. That offered different hotlines and crisis response teams and things like that. That's where I began to get my professional experience in crisis and trauma. So I have kind of a unique set of qualifications because I have very personal experience with trauma, and then I have the professional background and the education to support good, healthy coping skills and resiliency focus," Quintanar said. Created after the August 31st, 2019 mass shooting, the governor's office selected PermiaCare, the local mental health authority, as the agency to lead the Family Resiliency Center. "We started talking about services, and we looked at other resiliency centers, and we tried to look at what other centers have offered successfully. What's been beneficial? Then, of course, look specifically at Midland and Odessa to see what we thought would help these communities, because we didn't just want to recreate something. We want it to be what's going to be the most helpful here," Quintanar said. She added that they spoke to some of the other centers and figured out that one of the most beneficial things would be to offer some alternative therapies and wellness services like trauma-informed yoga, art workshops, and other creative outlets. We're going to start with yoga and art workshops. It's just going to be a way for people to focus on something positive when the negative starts to become overwhelming. Then the other thing is, we don't want to be like, you can just do yoga and all of your cares will be gone, because trauma is a very real thing, and we want to make sure we help people process their trauma and not get over it, because I don't believe that's an accurate statement, but learn coping skills to help them deal with it, Quintanar said. In person, the center will offer yoga Tuesdays and Thursdays at 5 p.m. Tuesday is the intro class, and Thursday will become, starting in July, more advanced. Quintanar said it is trauma-informed yoga. It just means it's sensitive to folks who might have experienced trauma. What that means is the movements are very intentional. Even before physically distancing was a thing, we were still providing distancing so people didn't feel like they were crowded. There's no loud music. There's no music at all. We don't do hot or cold extremes. The movements are very slow and steady and calming. It's just kind of a softer, gentler yoga, Quintanar said. Art workshops will start Saturdays. We're really excited about that. And then hopefully in July, we'll square away our music groups. And we think that's going to kind of look like an open mic night without the booze. We can't have alcohol here, but we want it to be a place where people can just come and share whatever makes them feel better. So if that's playing a song or singing or poetry or really anything that is therapeutic, that is kind of from the section of life, she said. The center is offering psychological first aid and skills for psychological recovery starts in July. And those are blended, so there's an online portion and an in-person portion. Then in August, we'll be doing mental health first aid. And in September, I'm most excited about some suicide prevention stuff that we're going to start doing, Quintanar said. We're going to work with the founder of 1-800-SUICIDE. I've worked with him for a long time. He is actually going to help us get some classes available, but also we're going to actually start doing some research and offering some training to first responders, law enforcement. But we really want to push this training into the community so that we can make a difference. There's been an increase in suicides. There's been an increase since the shooting, because that's pretty much a common response, unfortunately, to violence, especially when you have so many families affected in so many locations. The shootings took place in many different locations between Odessa and Midland. Many mass shootings that take place have one central location, she said. Along with yoga, art, and the other services, there will be a variety of support groups and counseling referrals to centers for children and families. If someone comes here and we meet with them and determine that would be beneficial, the grant actually allows to pay for the first 6 sessions with a licensed counselor, so we will refer to Centers for Children and Families for that, so we can meet all of the needs. When he gets older, the center will also have a therapy dog named Cooper, an Australian Shepherd and Golden Retriever mix. He is still a year out from being certified, so he just keeps us company and makes people smile when he's not jumping on them. But eventually he'll get there. He won't get certification until he's a year old, but right now he just gives kisses and hugs. Quintanar said the center has probably served about 100 people since it opened. And they get 50-plus viewers for yoga over Facebook Live when it's offered. Outreach specialist Denise Johnson assists Quintanar in her work. She's learning as she goes. I've got a background in mental health and social services, but it's a different ball of wax dealing with trauma related to this type of shooting. Having the Family Resiliency Center, she said, is crucial. I think it's vital, and what we do here, it stemmed from the shooting, but the pandemic stuff is important. This is just the base of what we do and why we're funded. In the long run, I think it's important to almost any community, Johnson said. Group counseling sessions can also be held in a closed room without windows in the event the visitors to the Family Resiliency Center are more comfortable in a more closed setting. Funded through government grants, the Family Resiliency Center services are free to the public. After school care. This fall, Campfire will be offering a state-licensed, affordable, quality school care for students on 10 Odessa campuses: Austin, Burnett, Gonzales, Noel, Pease, Buise, Cameron, Ross, Burleson, and Jordan Elementary Schools. Children must attend the school offering the Kids Care Program to be eligible. Registration will begin at 9 a.m. July 13th and will continue until all spots are filled. The after-school programs are operated by Campfire West Texas, and components of the program include homework help, games, arts and crafts, outdoor recreation, and traditional campfire activities and projects. The program will be offered from the time school is out through 6 p.m. Enrollment will be limited, with a child-to-adult ratio of no more than 15 to 1 to provide attention and quality supervision. To register for Kids Care, complete an online registration form and pay a $20 annual fee for each child enrolled. A weekly $50 fee will be charged per child, and financial assistance is available for those who qualify. Online registration forms are only available at www.campfirewtx.org. For more information, call the Campfire West Texas office at 570-4144. Man charged with breaking into woman's apartment and harassing her. An Odessa Police Department affidavit detailed a 30-year-old man was arrested after he broke into a woman's apartment, stole items, and called her more than 80 times. Christopher Anderson was charged with burglary of habitation, a second-degree felony, stalking, third-degree felony, unlawful carrying of a weapon, Class A misdemeanor, and possession of marijuana, a Class B misdemeanor. The reported burglary occurred June 20th at the Woodview Apartments, 4330 North Grandview, the affidavit stated. Corina Ornelas reportedly told officers that while she was out of town, a man identified as Anderson broke into her apartment. She stated that Anderson was not her boyfriend, but they had been romantically involved over the last 4 months, and she decided to end their relationship. Ornelas stated Anderson had been harassing her by calling her more than 88 times and knowing her location without her communication with him. Ornelas stated she left town using her friend's vehicle, and while she was out of town, Anderson called her 9 times on Facebook Messenger, to which she replied, "Leave me alone." Anderson reportedly called her 8 more times and then texted her, "You might want to get home soon." Ornelas stated she blocked him on Facebook Messenger. Anderson reportedly called her 88 times from a no-caller ID number. Ornelas answered one of the phone calls, and Anderson told her she needed to return home because her property was messed up. Once Ornelas returned to her residence, she found that her kitchen window had been broken, along with the screen torn off. She found her fridge to be open and everything thawed out. She stated her bedroom and bathroom had been ransacked and her underwear, brass knuckles, and a gun case were taken. Ornelas was reportedly in fear of what Anderson would do next, so she changed her phone number and blocked Anderson on all social media. She stated she boarded up her kitchen window, and on June 21st, she saw her handgun case had been returned and left on her chair next to the front door porch, and the boards were removed, but she was unsure if he had made entry into her apartment. June 22nd, Ornelas stated she returned to her residence and found a handwritten note on her front door from Anderson, in which he apologized for letting his emotions get the best of him and asked her for a second chance to make their relationship work. She stated she ignored the note and did not contact Anderson. At midnight, June 23rd, Anderson reportedly went back to Ornelas' residence and started knocking on the front door. Ornelas stated she didn't answer the door, and after 45 minutes, she checked outside and found roses sitting on the chair next to the front door on the porch, along with the brass knuckles that were taken from the burglary. Ornelas provided photos of the text messages and hundreds of phone calls from Anderson that are harassing in nature, along with the handwritten letter in which he apologized for his actions. Anderson was arrested and booked into the Ector County Law Enforcement Center June 24th, jail records show. He has four bonds totaling $43,000 and was still in custody as of Friday afternoon. Community Forum allows citizens to voice concerns, by Royal McGregor. In defense of Black Lives, a local activist group held a community forum to address concerns about policing, criminal justice, and education in Odessa. The forum, Talk of the Town, Policing, Education, and Next Steps to Solutions, lasted more than 2 hours as a handful of in-person community members and Facebook Live viewers voiced their opinions and experiences with law enforcement. During Thursday's forum at Floyd Gwynn Park, citizens voiced their concerns about mental health, programs to assist low-income families, police surveillance on specific areas of the city, racial profiling, training for law enforcement, and trust with law enforcement. Gavin Norris, a local attorney and one of In Defense of Black Lives organizers, said after the forum, the concerns and opinions that were voiced will be brought up during meetings with members of the police department and city officials in the future. Our measure was the quality content and the quality of feedback from the community, Norris said. Do we have substantive information to go back with? I believe we accomplished that. That is how we define success, and I believe it was successful. Before the forum began, Norris addressed the crowd and said that members of the Odessa City Council and Odessa Police Department weren't specifically invited, but he explained after the meeting that any were welcome to attend. The only member of Odessa City Council to show up was at-large council member Peggy Dean, who jotted down notes during the forum. Norris said after the forum that it was meaningful to have Dean attend. When you have an elective official who is voted at large by the entire city and they decide that they are going to show up to what some may consider unpopular, but to learn and to listen, not to impose their thoughts or views, there are no words that you can say that really describe the appreciation and the effect that has on a community, Norris said. I will always praise her for being here in a moment that would be unpopular for a lot of folks. Dean spoke with the Odessa American after the forum, and she said that she wasn't personally invited but wanted to come to learn. She also said while she spoke during the protest march, which was also organized by In Defense of Black Lives on June 3rd following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, that she received boos from the crowd. I've spent the last 2 weeks doing a tremendous amount of research, trying to understand this problem from its very core, Dean said. I decided that I was going to learn as much as I could. I've met with the chief of police. We've started a task force at the city. I said to Gavin early on that you've issued a call to action, but you have a lot of us who are willing to respond, but we clearly don't know what all the issues are. I've made it my mission to find out the issues and try to be part of the solution and not part of the program. There was a ranging demographic that attended the forum, which included citizens, multiple professors from UTPB, a presiding judge in Ector County, and a member of Odessa's City Council who attended the event. At the tail end of the forum, 446th District Court Judge Sarah Kate Billingsley was invited to share a few words, and she said that concerns her that some people are worried when they are pulled over. Our biggest problem is lack of general understanding, Billingsley said. That creates an us versus them, or a we versus they. There were more than 24 members of the community who showed up to the in-person forum that was originally scheduled to take place at Floyd Gwynn Park Gym, but it was moved outdoors to allow more people to participate while still following social distancing guidelines. Community members who attended in person wore masks. Norris said this forum was one step in a multi-phase plan, and he explained the communication must continue for change to be made. We will continue to have this conversation, Norris said. What normally happens is we have these conversations, we have a great event, and then it dies off. Our goal is to continue to have these community conversations, whether they are large like this, or we work with our city members to have small town halls. Once we find the solutions, we have to make sure when we are having these small town halls that we have the chief of police and the city council members there to say, are we implementing them? If we are they effective? If not, where do we need to revisit those?
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, June 28th, 2020. Time to vote. Sales tax election puts health care on center stage. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HearstNP.com. The Midland County Hospital District's quarter-cent sales tax election is also Midland's first election during the coronavirus pandemic. Instead of campaign rallies, parties, and luncheons, there are Zoom meetings. Rosalind Redfern Grover doesn't like it one bit. There are too many people who haven't been reached, she said. COVID is a major distraction. The drop in oil prices is a major distraction, Grover said. I haven't found any major opposition. When someone says they are against it, I tell them the story. Once they hear the story, they say, oh, I want to do that. Her story includes this sales tax, not an increase in the property tax. The story also includes that 21% of the patients in Midland Memorial Hospital come from outside Midland County. This is a way to help them pay for it, Grover said. The counties around us don't have hospitals like we have. They depend on us. Maybe a challenge makes this a fair fight for Grover. She was the architect of the 2009 hospital bond, the first $100 million bond passed in Midland County. The $115 million bond passed by nearly 30%. She said last week, when you show Midlanders a well-thought-out initiative, they make the right choice. We have thought this out. The problem is amplifying the message. Early voting for the July 14th election begins Monday. On the ballot is a quarter-cent increase to the sales tax collected inside the city of Midland and Midland County. Currently, the sales tax on eligible items inside the city is 8%. The cap inside the state of Texas is 8.25 cents. Proposition A proponents believe the revenue from a countywide sales tax increase could raise up to $30 million a year, money they believe will help make up for cuts in federal funding. Midland Health CEO Russell Myers has stated he anticipates a $38.4 million drop in the district's annual Medicaid supplement reimbursement by fiscal year 2024. Without extra revenue, Medicaid supplement reimbursement reductions will impact community health care services funding, Myers said. That includes 501As, the nonprofits, Midland Community Health Care Services, such as the Coleman Clinic, contracted physicians, the district's partnership with Texas Tech University Health Science Center, mental health partnerships with Oceans Behavior Hospital and the Springboard Drug and Alcohol Treatment Facility, and ER calls. Myers said combined funding reached $40.147 million in fiscal year 2019. That figure, he said, included at least some compensation for 200 doctors, or about 75% of the medical staff. If nothing is done now, the hospital's unrestricted cash would be impacted. Hospital officials expect it to fall from $29.6 million at the end of fiscal year 2020 to a deficit of $8.115 million at the end of fiscal year 2024. Healthcare has changed, Grover told the Reporter-Telegram. People are not aware of changes. They think of it as television doctor Marcus Welby carrying his little black bag. That is not how it happens. They are sophisticated doctors making important decisions and using sophisticated techniques and saving lives. It is amazing, and you have to pay for that. To provide more context to the amount of money needed to make up for anticipated Medicaid reductions, Myers said the hospital district would be required to raise the amount of property tax revenue by 72% next year, 13% in fiscal year 2022, 12% in 23, and 1% in 24. That equals to a 119% increase compared to the baseline in 2020. Grover said a sales tax increase spreads the burden more broadly, and the impact of a quarter-cent increase is an additional quarter on a $100 purchase, or as Grover put it, a penny on $4 McDonald's Happy Meals. The election will be on the same ballot as the Republican and Democratic Party runoffs. That means there is only one other local election, the runoff for the 142nd District Judge between David Rogers and Mary Baker. Proposition A supporters had hoped for a May election date, but elections were delayed because of the coronavirus. The date became the question. Would it have to wait for November or earlier in the fall? In May, hospital officials, in consultation with the governor's office, fully determined July would be the month. At the time, Myers said that waiting until November to hold the election would have cost the hospital district about half a year's worth of collections if the measure is approved. It remains to be seen if the coronavirus pandemic will have people focused on health care and its value to the community. Grover said hires made in the past 2 years include a critical care unit doctor and an infectious disease doctor. How providential is that, she said. Coronavirus has hindered efforts by Midlanders to congregate, whether it is for work, play, school, or politics. School campuses were closed for the final 3 months of the school year. Businesses were forced to have to take out only and then opened 25 to 50% at a time. For Grover, presentations have been limited, mostly to 20 or 30 at a time. Her worry leading up to the election day is the people she hasn't reached. And while telling her story isn't most effective on a flat screen, she will take anything she can get. She said if there is a church group, club, or organization that wants to hear her story, they can send an email to info@sayyestohealthcare.com. I'm better in person, Grover said, but that is not an option today. A commentary by Tim Dunn, Crown Quest Operating CEO. MCHD sales tax leads to healthcare self-sufficiency. I encourage Midland residents to vote on July 14th, or take advantage of early voting between June 29th and July 10th, and vote for Proposition A for Midland Health. Proposition A adds a quarter-cent sales tax dedicated to the Midland County Hospital District, taking our total sales tax rate to 8.25%. Midland voters approved a quarter-cent sales tax in 1999 to pay the debt on the Scarber Sports Complex. That quarter-cent tax rate expired in 2017. The community wisely voted not to reauthorize that tax and made it available under state law to support local health care. In general, taxes are too high, particularly property taxes. It is essential for us to have roads, water, and health care for Midland to be viable, much less thrive and prosper as a community. But property taxes are a bad approach. Most of the cost burden is invisible. Business owners pass their property taxes down to consumers through hidden costs in the form of higher rent or purchase prices. Midland Memorial Hospital currently receives about 10% of its budget with a property tax. Hopefully, that tax won't increase. High property taxes violate a founding principle of American private property ownership. Property taxes have escalated to the point that we are now only co-owners of our property. We first purchase the property to have the title. Then, through property taxes, we must pay the government the purchase price again, about every 20 years at current rates. Sales taxes are the only broad-based, transparent, and optional forms of taxation. We only pay sales taxes when we choose to purchase something that's a non-necessity. Essential goods like food are exempt. People who spend more pay more. People with less money pay less, all in full view. The healthcare system has been particularly fouled up by federal government intervention. Our local hospital is saddled with an increasing number of federal regulations that require them to incur costs without additional federal funding. Regulations should be boundaries within the game of life. However, in many cases, laws are instead passed for political reasons and create burdens without a commensurate benefit. The current healthcare system imposes costs on consumers without transparency. If a vehicle repair company charged one person $10,000 and someone else $1,000, depending on insurance bargaining, they would be castigated on 60 Minutes. But that kind of thing is typical in American healthcare system. What if you couldn't get an estimate of the cost before choosing whether to get the car repaired? You would go to another place, but in the part of the system covered by insurance government, you can't get estimates or certainty of billing. It's a mess. Change is inevitable. It behooves us to begin setting the stage to be self-sufficient and support healthcare within our community. The more we fund locally, the more we set ourselves up to function apart from regulations that require inefficiencies and twist incentives. I am told federal reimbursements to the hospital have dropped more than $30 million annually, roughly the amount this tax will fund. I don't understand why the reimbursements have dropped, given that federal deficits are soaring. But I think we are better off reducing reliance on Washington, D.C. to take care of our local health care needs. This quarter-cent sales tax creates a transparent and local revenue source for MCHD that helps Midland down the path of self-sufficiency. For my part, I would like the community to consider eliminating or repurposing some other consumption taxes to further support health care. 1% of our sales tax collected goes to the city, 0.5% goes to the county, and 0.25% goes to Midland Development Corp. It seems that spending money on health care is a better economic development expenditure than paying a large company to move to town. That might require state legislation, but it is the sort of thing we ought to consider. Approving the MCHD sales tax is a good path for us. There is an enormous nationwide healthcare mess to be cleaned up, but taking steps toward local self-sufficiency is a positive step. I invite you to vote in favor of Proposition A. Don't forget to vote for District Judge while you're at it.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.